This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
Welcome to The Limits. I'm Jay Williams. And this week, I'm in my bag of mixtape mode. And that's what we're doing here in The Limits. That means we're taking a look back at three of my favorite guest conversations because they're all tied to the news at the moment. You see, these guys are always staying relevant. First up is media mogul Charlamagne Tha God, or Char as I like to call him. He was one of our first guests on the show, and he's still teaching me things about how to learn and how to evolve. Last week, his longtime co-host of The Breakfast Club, Angela Yee, announced she's headed off to do her own thing, her own show. Congratulations, Angela. And Char is showing us all how to stay positive and be thankful for great work done together. Then, with the NFL preseason underway, we flash back to one of our best conversations with former Miami Dolphins head coach Brian Flores. If you missed his story back in February, Brian filed a class action lawsuit against the NFL, alleging discrimination in the hiring of head coaches. The Dolphins have since been punished by the league. Although Brian hasn't gotten the justice he was seeking, at least not yet, he's now with the Pittsburgh Steelers, assisting under one of only three black head coaches left in the NFL. That's crazy to even say out loud, especially for a sport that's dominated by African-American players. Brian is a reminder to us all that representation matters, especially in leadership. And speaking of coaches and leadership, we also hear from my coach, Michael Krzyzewski, also known as Coach K. He's the legendary Duke coach who led me and my team to win a national title in the year 2001, which he would also do a total of five times. He's coached hundreds of players to greatness in the NCAA, the NBA, and the Olympics. He talked to me about some of the toughest moments in a marathon of a career and what he's looking forward to in his first year of retirement. So no more waiting. Let's get to it right now. The Limits mixtape. I told you I'm in my bag. Here we go.
Good morning, Angela Yee.
Good morning, DJ MV.
Charlamagne Tha God.
So like I mentioned, co-host of The Breakfast Club, Angela Yee, announced last week that she is now headed off to do her own thing and have her own show on iHeartRadio.
They are going to give me my very own show, a nationally syndicated daily show. But I am going to be leaving The Breakfast Club. You guys obviously will continue on.
So I'd like to give a big shout out to Angela Yee. I've always thought that she's been extremely talented, and I am so thankful that now she gets blessed with a platform where she can show the world that she can be a one-woman wrecking crew. But the show goes on now with DJ Envy and Charlamagne Tha God holding it down. And I know that Char couldn't be prouder of his colleague for doing big things.
The Angela Yee Show and Lip Service Podcast being nationally syndicated is huge.
Yes.
You know, not just for the culture of radio, but for podcasts. That's major. That's bigly.
You see, this is what I love. When a team could go through so much and still have the ultimate respect for each other. Now, these hosts have been through thick and thin together, taking their show from the headquarters of hip hop, talking to everybody in music, to evolving into a necessary stop for politicians on the campaign trail, including Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Kamala Harris. Charlamagne talked to me about how he went from being the only black kid in class for high-achieving students to finishing high school from a jail cell. He also describes how he tackles controversy on the airwaves, which comes up relentlessly these days. Here's what Char had to say. I've had some of the most riveting conversations with you, and the evolution of your thinking is something that a lot more people need to hear. But bring me back, because I'm curious to learn about a young Leonard McKelvey from Monk's Corner in South Carolina. Tell me about your upbringing. Tell me about some of the things that occurred in your life that shaped who you are today.
My mother was an English teacher, you know, so she kept me in books. You know what I mean? I was in the bookie program. Like, I was always reading. So, you know, from first grade to about sixth grade, I was in, you know, all these accelerated classes. But, you know, when you get to middle school and you the black kid with the glasses and the fanny pack and everybody in the accelerated classes is white except for like one or two people. So in the morning, you hanging out with the white kids waiting to go to your class. But then you got your cousins, you know, who aren't in the accelerated classes. And, you know, they the guys that's the cool kids, right? They the ones that, you know, got their hat on backwards and the baggy clothes. Like, they the cool kids, and they know my pops. So they see me hanging out with the white kids, and they like, yo, you acting like a white boy. So they bully me, right? Push me around, you know, punch on me. White dudes like, man, I can't be around you because, you know, these dudes is punking you every morning. Like, I don't want no parts of that. So now you're just stuck in this space, right? You're stuck in this space where you're not really accepted by the white kids. And then you don't fit in really with your cousins. So, like, you just kind of, like, stuck in the middle trying to figure it out. And then for me, around seventh grade, man, I just was like, man, if you can't beat them, join them. You know, so I just started hanging out with the hood dudes. I started hanging out with my cousins, you know, and thugging. And like most things in my life, if I'm going to be a part of it, I'm going to try to be the best at it. So I was doing, you know, anything I had to do to prove that I was down.
What does that mean, Lemnart?
Whatever they was doing that they thought was tough, I was going to do it times 10. Oh, we going to fight? Okay, I'll go punch the person first. You know what I mean? Oh, we going to... You shoplift out the store? All right, I'm gonna make sure I steal the most stuff. Just dumb stuff. Just, you know, and we used to call it peer pressure, but it's not peer pressure. It's literally just us wanting to be accepted. And that's something I learned in therapy. We used to always, peer pressure to me is like you blaming other people for your problems. Like you blaming other people for the choices that you made. It's like, no, I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be down. And I was willing to do whatever I needed to do to be accepted and be down. And eventually ended up getting kicked out of school because those disciplinary problems in school led to me running the streets. You know, you started getting into drugs and, you know, carrying guns and all types of other stupid stuff. So I ended up getting expelled out of one high school, Berkeley High School, and they transferred me to Scranton High School where my mama taught. And then I ended up getting arrested out of there because I was involved in a shooting, like literally sitting in the backseat of the car while somebody was in the front shooting. And, you know, no snitching. So I end up going to jail, and you know, I finished high school in night school.
Wait, you finished high school in night school?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell pushed you to get to that point? What made you decide, hey, now I want to be serious about it?
Thank God, you know, listening to my father would always say, if I didn't change my lifestyle, I would end up in jail, dead or broke, sitting under the tree. And I always subscribed to this great quote, and the quote is, you know, smart people learn from their own mistakes, wise people learn from the mistakes of others. So when I went to jail the first time, and then I saw people around me actually going to prison, you know, getting 5 years at a time, you know, 10 years at a time, when people around me actually started getting killed, you know, in Monk's Corner, I was like, damn, Pops is right. And I was like, yo, that's not going to be me. So I just started doing the exact opposite of what everybody else was doing. If everybody was hanging out under the tree, I was the one going to work an odd job. I was working 3-4 different jobs at one time. You know what I mean? So that's when everybody wasn't going to school and didn't have a diploma, I said, okay, I'm going to go back to night school and, you know, get my diploma. And that's what I did.
You know, I had to go into Newark a couple of years ago and did a docuseries called Best Shot with LeBron and Maverick Carter, where we went into the local high school, and it wasn't just about giving back monetary value. It was about giving back time equity, spending time with a lot of these young kids. And you saw that a lot of them were so much a byproduct of their environment, and that their environment refused to help them grow or evolve if it didn't fit what that community's narrative was, right? Like if you were trying to do something positive, or you're trying to learn about calculus or chemistry, it was almost made fun of in order to keep you constrained or keep you restricted or, you know, shackled to this past mindset that this is the only way we know how to get through. And if you decide to do it a different way, then that's not our way, which means you're an outcast. I'm sure you hear about a lot of stuff like that as it pertains to your own story, but how do you talk to a kid that has those type of struggles?
Man, I mean, transcending my circumstances, That's been my...
I like that.
That's been my story. You know what I mean? And I always, for some reason, knew that I was bigger than the environment that I was in. And that's what I would tell these kids. That's what I do tell these kids. I tell these kids, man, it doesn't matter how you start. It matters how you finish, you know? And, you know, be that rose that grew from concrete. Don't look around at your circumstances and say to yourself, this is my end all and my be all. No, this is where you are now. You know, where do you see yourself mentally 5 years from now, right? Where do you see yourself mentally 10 years from now? Because wherever you see yourself mentally 5 years from now, mentally 10 years from now, you can physically be there. If all you know is the hood, if you've embraced the hood and you said, this is all it's going to be, this is what I'm going to do. Like, we really do embrace the hood like that because we don't know anything else. I'm from Mount's Corner, South Carolina. Even though I've transcended my circumstances, I still represent Mount's Corner to the fullest because so much of who I am is that place.
So what if I had told that kid sitting in that jail cell that one day he would become one of the most unique, polarizing, authoritative, and rational voices in the culture today? What would you have said?
I would have believed you. You know, back then, you know, one of the first books that I was put in my hand was the autobiography of Malcolm X. You know, and from the autobiography of Malcolm X, I read Message to the Black Man by Elijah Muhammad. And I read this other great book in jail called From Niggas to Gods by Akil. My point with saying all that is all those books were about evolution. All those books were about how men can grow, how people can grow.
You sound like a pretty empathetic dude, man. And I got to tell you, it's fascinating because when I read articles about you, I see things or quotes from people like he's the hip hop Howard Stern, or, you know, this guy is extremely polarizing, or it's things that kind of incite emotion. When people say things about you and who you were, even though that's not who you are now, how do you redirect that? How do you rechannel that?
Honestly, I mean, I still might be polarizing to some people, but for me, man, it's just like, you got to allow people to grow. You got to allow people to evolve. I was a very confused, you know, young man at that time. Like when I first got on Breakfast Club, you got to think, I had just gotten fired 4 times from radio. So I was just coming off a year of unemployment, you know, being 30, 31 years old, living at home with my mom, with my 1-2-year-old daughter, you know, living with me, and my now wife back home living with her parents, you know, because we couldn't afford to live in New Jersey no more. So when I got that gig at the Breakfast Club, it was about survival for me. So I was wilding. And then when you start reading magazine articles about you and they are saying things like, oh, he's hip-hop Howard Stern, what does that even mean? You know what I mean? I never even took the time to step back and say, well, what does that mean when they say that? They might be saying that because they think I'm an exceptional interviewer. They might be saying that because, you know, I don't bite my tongue. Who knows? But for me, I feel like I took all of the worst attributes of Howard and started, you know, acting like that. I just wish that, you know, they weren't stuck on that. Because sometimes people would be so stuck on who you were that they're not even appreciating who you're becoming or who you've become.
How do you even navigate when something comes in on the fly? Like, give me an example, like something that is very controversial and then you're supposed to just come up with some kind of thought and you know you have millions of people that are just waiting to hear what you have to say about it.
I don't even do that no more. Back in the day, I would just, because I didn't know any better, right? So I would hear something and immediately form an opinion about it for exactly what you just said because people expected me to have something to say, you know? And I didn't take a step back a lot of times and just examine it from a human perspective. So is there a right or wrong in this situation? No. You know, is there a bad idea a lot of times? Yeah. Like I would rather talk about the idea than the individual. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Shar, I know exactly what you mean. And like so many others, I can listen to Shar talk all day, every day. After the break, NFL coach Brian Flores speaks out right after he was fired by the Miami Dolphins in February. I still get chills thinking of how awful that whole situation must have felt and how much strength it took for him to go public. He accused Dolphins owner Stephen Ross of racist hiring practices and of offering him money to lose games. Talk about competitive integrity, huh? Stay with us. You're listening to The Limits from NPR. I'm Jay Williams.
This message comes from Schwab. It's easy to invest in ideas you believe in with Schwab Investing Themes, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, and electric vehicles. Choose from over 40 customizable themes. More at schwab.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your boundaries, how to recharge, and your social sweet spot so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Try therapy with BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Imagine a house where every room follows a different architect's plan. Doorways don't connect. Staircases lead nowhere. Lost Patients is a new podcast examining our complicated system for treating psychosis, one that loses patients to an endless loop between the streets, jail, and hospitals. We'll ask how it got so bad and how it can get better. Listen to Lost Patients from KUOW and the Seattle Times, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to The Limits. And we're listening to a mixtape version of some of our greatest conversations on the show yet. And now we flash back to the firing of Brian Flores. He spoke to me just about 48 hours after it happened. Here's what went down. Brian was the head coach of the Miami Dolphins before getting let go. And he filed a lawsuit against the Dolphins, the Denver Broncos, and the New York Giants. He alleges that these teams and the NFL as a whole engaged in racist hiring practices and racial discrimination. Brian says that the Dolphins owner, Stephen Ross, didn't give him a fair shake, even asking him to lose games on purpose to secure a better draft pick for the team. The Dolphins were punished this month by forfeiting prime draft picks in the next 2 years, and Stephen Ross was charged a $1.5 million fine. Despite all that, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell denies that any racial bias nor losing on purpose even took place. The official court case is still ongoing. Now in our interview, we hear how hard Brian had to work to reach the coaching mountaintop. And we also hear how a misdirected text message from Patriots head coach Bill Belichick confirmed to Brian that something really sketchy was going on and that he needed to sue. Back to the show.
So I got to ask you, man, these past 48 hours, seems like it's been quite a whirlwind. How have you emotionally been handling everything?
It's been a tough 48 hours. Making a decision to file a lawsuit, I went back and forth on that. I did. I knew that it was, you know, it was a sacrifice that I was making, but I also felt like it was necessary. And this isn't about me. This is about, you know, something that's much bigger than me, which is a system in the NFL that, in my opinion, is broken as far as hiring practices for black and minority coaches and minorities in general.
What cemented your decision? You say you were back and forth. What got you over that hump?
Well, it was the text message from Bill Belichick that confirmed a lot of the things that I believed were going on for blacks, minorities in the hiring process. That was the tipping point for me. And, you know, that confirmation was something that I felt like I had to say something. I couldn't stay silent because, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King said, you know, a long, long time ago, there comes a time where silence becomes betrayal. And I wasn't going to do that.
Take me back to Miami. Why were you fired?
You know, when you have two back-to-back winning seasons, you don't really feel like that's, you know, you're going to get fired. My son asked me, you know, what happened? You know, my sons have, you know, two sons and a daughter. My son Miles is 8. He'll be 9. My son Maxwell is 7. He'll be 8. My daughter just turned 5. So I was at a princess party a couple weekends ago, right in my element. So my son Miles, who's become a huge football fan, both my sons. He asked me, he goes, you know, what happened, Dad? Why'd you get fired? And I said, son, no, most of the time, you know, you get fired when you fail. That's normally how this goes. So I couldn't give him a real answer. He's like, we didn't fail. I know we didn't fail. You know, it just didn't work out. My son Maxwell came home and said his friend from school I don't want to say a name, but so-and-so's dad said you got fired because you're black. So these are conversations I'm having to have with a, you know, 8 and 7 year old. And those are tough conversations to have. But why? I think, you know, there were some strained relationships between myself, ownership, because I wouldn't adhere to some of the things that they wanted me to do with the team that I felt was unethical.
Part of the tension between you and Stephen Ross, owner of the Dolphins, was that you were asked to tank games.
Yeah.
You say he was willing to pay you $100,000 per game that you lost so that the Dolphins would then be able to be at the bottom of the league and get the first pick in the NFL draft. Crazy, that first pick in the draft would have been Joe Burrow, who is now in the Super Bowl. With that being said, is there anyone that can corroborate your accusation?
You know, without getting into specifics, you know, I'll say that other people were aware.
And how did you handle that in that moment?
Look, I grew up not too far from here. And I grew up in a housing project in Brooklyn, not too far from here. My parents are immigrants. They came over to this country looking for the American dream, basically, for their children. And my mom was big on education. And I've got four brothers. And I worked hard to get to this spot. And football's opened a lot of doors for me. Doors that, you know, would never have been open, you know. Much like basketball was that for you. So to disrespect the game, you know, that's done so much for me was something that, you know, that was a tough conversation. And I voiced my opinion on why that would never happen. Why I would never, take part in anything like that. And I think if you heard my story, if you understood where I came from, understood the things that the work that was put in to get into that position, you would understand why I would react the way I did.
You say you refused to tank games, and because of that, you were casted as, quote, an angry black man. What's an example of that?
Well, you know, I most certainly have a strong personality. I think you have to have that as a coach in the National Football League. I'm demanding, and I challenge, and I address problems, and I challenge players and coaches and support staff to improve and get better. But white coaches do the exact same thing, and you never really hear the angry white man. You don't hear that term very often. I think that's a picture you can paint, but if you walk around the Miami Dolphins building and you talk to the kitchen staff and talk to the field crew and talk to security and talk to IT and talk to equipment and medical, that's not what you're going to hear about Brian Flores from those people in that building.
I have a statement here from Dolphins owner Stephen Ross. And he has responded to your allegations by saying, quote, "I take great personal exception to these malicious attacks, and the truth must be known. His allegations are false, malicious, and defamatory. We understand there are media reports stating that the NFL intends to investigate his claims, and we will cooperate fully. I welcome that investigation, and I'm eager to defend my personal integrity and the integrity and values of the entire Miami Dolphins organization from these baseless, unfair, and disparaging claims." What's your reaction to that when you hear those words?
Let's let it play out. One thing about me is, and you'll hear this from players, coaches, I tell people the truth, whether it's good or bad, and I think that's the way, the best way to operate, to deal in transparency. I say, let's just let it play out.
Has Stephen ever put you in a precarious situation?
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned the tanking already. I mean, that's well known. So I would say, if anything is a precarious situation, that would be it. Specifically, but I guess my thought on that is, no one can really put you in a precarious situation, because at the end of the day, you either say yes or no, and You, if that means going against what some other people may want to do, if you feel like that's the right thing to do, then you stand on that and have peace about it. And I have a lot of peace.
So you get fired from the Miami Dolphins. Your name is being floated around for a multitude of job opportunities, one being here for the New York Giants, which I'm a fan of, by the way. I was pushing for you to be here. I'll just be transparent about that. And so Joe Shane gets brought here to run the Giants as a GM from Buffalo. And you get a text message from Bill Belichick essentially congratulating you. Take me through that situation. Explain to me what happened.
So the hiring process is, it's a lot that goes on. There's a lot of phone calls that are being had. Agent, myself, teams. So I would say 10 minutes prior to the text message from Bill, I got a call from Joe Sheen saying, hey, we want to bring you in for an interview.
So you had not been in for an interview yet?
I had not been in for an interview yet. I just got a call that said, hey, we want to set up the interview for Thursday. So 10 minutes later, I get the text message from Bill saying, I don't have it in front of me, but, oh, it seems like you have landed. Congrats. And then it was a back and forth. So in that moment, I'm elated. Wow. You know, Bill is having conversations with the Giants, and they must feel strongly about me. And
for people who don't know, Bill Belichick, one of the greatest coaches of all time, general manager, coach of the New England Patriots. I was a player with Tom Brady, very informed. He would be more informed than any past normal person.
Yeah, he's in the know.
Yes.
He's in the know, which, as we'll probably talk about afterwards, is probably a little bit of part of the problem. So I'm rereading the text, and you know, the Buffalo part of it was, that didn't make sense to me. So I asked him, are you talking to Brian Flores or Brian Daboll? And I got the text message back saying, which said he misread the text and Brian Daboll was going to be named coach of the Giants. And this was 3 days before I was going to interview.
You had not even interviewed for the opportunity yet. Meanwhile, the Giants organization had already had somebody that they had picked that you're getting this information from Bill to secure the job.
Yes. Yes. And again, this isn't about me. My story is just an example, you know, one of probably many examples of situations where black and minority coaches aren't getting the equal opportunity to interview, showcase their ability, showcase their acumen, showcase their leadership in front of these owners. I'm not sure Daboll had even gotten in front of them. But blacks and minorities aren't given that opportunity, and it was confirmed to me that day.
Now look, I am still baffled and still can't believe that interview was just 2 days after the news broke about Brian Flores' lawsuit against his old team and the entire NFL. Now I know that Brian is used to being in high pressure situations, but this dude was as cool as ice when the brightest lights were suddenly blaring down on him. We wish him all the best this season with the Steelers and for years to come. After the break, we hear from the one and only Coach K, who recently retired after 4 decades of coaching Duke men's basketball to glory over and over and over again. You're listening to The Limits from NPR. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy. Support for NPR and the following message come from Jarl and Pamela Moan, thanking the people who make public radio great every day and also those who listen.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tech strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging. These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Spend time in any American city, and you'll likely encounter someone with untreated psychosis. Lost Patients is a new podcast examining our maze-like system for treating severe mental illness, which loses patients to an endless loop between the streets, jail, and hospitals. Does it have to be this way? For the history, the reality, and hopefully some solutions, listen to Lost Patients from KUOW and the Seattle Times, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to The Limits. That's right, you're back in the lab with me, Jay Williams. And we're closing out my conversation with the legendary Duke men's basketball coach, Michael Krzyzewski, or Coach K. He's the recently retired winningest college basketball coach in the history of the NCAA. And he's always a coach to me, one of the biggest mentors in my life since I myself played at Duke. Now, as you know, the school year is beginning, and Duke students are already lining up outside Cameron Indoor Stadium, getting ready to cheer on the Duke basketball team that I once led to a national championship. Coach K actually led them to 5 championships in total, along with multiple Olympic gold medals for the U.S. men's team. Coach K has done it all, and he talked to me about the toughest moments of his career and his plans for retirement. And trust me, he still got plenty of lessons we can all live by. Here's the one and only Coach K. I'm curious about when you had your back issue, herniated disc.
Right.
Can you take me through that? Because everybody has an accident in some form or fashion, right, Coach? Like how you managed that and trying to coach at the same time and the time it forced you to take away from the game, how difficult that was?
Well, you bring up another really important point. And that, like, when you were as a player, you were consumed with being that player, just like someone with immense talent in anything can be consumed. And a lot of other things were not important in developing. And it took what you went through and a lot of dark times to finally find out who you were supposed to be. You are who you are supposed to be now. A lot of people do not get through those dark times. For me, we had gone to 7 Final Fours in 9 years. I couldn't say no to anything, and I never had a break. I was always doing stuff. And then I had this back operation, but I had to have it immediately after we started practice that year because it was misdiagnosed, and I lost about a third of my left calf, the muscle. And if I didn't get it right away, I could have had what they call a drop foot. And so I had it, and they said, well, you should take this amount of time off. And again, you take a day or 2 days, and you come back. And I hit a wall, not just a physical wall, but a mental health wall. And by the end of December, you know, my wife in early January, Mickey, you got to get help. And if you don't get help today, I won't, when you come back from practice, I won't be here. And it took like that, and I did get help, and I had no feeling. You know, like literally, I mean, I could feel if you touched me. What I'm saying is I could not feel anything. Yeah, I could, you know, and it took me about 4 months and the belief of my athletic director, Tom Butters. I resigned at his home one night, and he said, you're not resigning. You're going to get well. And Keith Brody, one of my former presidents, worked with me every day. I would watch the Vegas game or the, and say, who is that guy? I can't do that. And you kept watching it and going through it. And finally, I developed a new way of looking at it and new way of leading and not being a micromanager. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate. And so you don't get through your dark times alone. And you didn't either. Yeah. Look, it happens to many people, but when it happens to somebody who has achieved a great deal in a certain aspect of our society, whether it be in medicine and sport and coaching and whatever, it's a little bit different. You get what I'm saying because you had to go through something similar, you know, and we were both consumed. And we needed more balance. And we weren't able to get it until something really happened to us. We had to, like, physically understand that you can't do this anymore.
Coach, was that Mickey for you? Because I know, you know, a lot of the things I went through, your voice was always ringing in my head. There were so many lessons that I learned on the court that you always talk about being applicable to life, right? But until you're really going through it,
right.
You're like, oh, now I see how that translates. Who was that? Who was Coach K's coach?
Well, you know, I'm lucky that I have a great family and my daughters, but my wife, you know, was the one who got it started and then stuck with me during this time. And by being around good people, like Dr. Brody was unbelievable, and Mr. Butters, they didn't give up on me. They believed that I could get it.
I think when I was hurt, when I rented a home, I think right down the street from you, it was the first time I ever got a chance to see, I've never even said your name out loud before, like Michael Krzyzewski, like the person I've always, you've been Coach K.
Right.
I remember I saw you picking up leaves and acorns and putting them in the back of your car. Mm-hmm. And it led me to believe, what the hell do you do with your free time, Coach?
Yeah, well, I do a lot of thinking. I'm not a golfer, so we have 14 acres of land and right next to the Duke Forest, and 8 of them are deer fenced.
Mm.
So we're able to have a beautiful property. And I like working out. Like this past weekend, I was cutting down stuff. I'm not a gardener, like I know every flower, but with trees and all that, I just like things looking good, and I like to be outside. And then with my dog, if he's with me, that's a cool thing. I like going for walks. I like being with my family. We're fortunate to have our 3 daughters and our 10 grandchildren right here. And then I'm trying to figure out exactly what I want to do instead of saying this is what I want to do and just jumping into a bunch of things. But I'm happy. I'll tell you, one of the biggest discoveries I've made since I retired, 2 of my granddaughters just graduated from high school.
I can't.
They're different, yeah. Carly and Emmy, and Carly graduated from St. Mary's, which is in Raleigh, an all-girls school, really good. And we're at the graduation. It's a Sunday morning, and it's outside, and it's beautiful. And 8 of my grandchildren are sitting right in front of me and Mickey. And sometimes graduations take a long, you know, they can be beautiful but tedious. And this one was really beautiful. And we're driving home, and I told Mickey, I said, that was happy. I said, you know, something happened that I can't remember when this has happened. I was only thinking of the graduation and my grandkids. Now, I have that focus for a game, don't get me wrong. And those people deserve that. When I am with my kids, my wife, I'm in that moment completely. And they don't even know that I was at a dance recital thinking about how the heck I'm going to make Jason Williams play harder or play some defense.
Just a little bit of defense, Jason.
Please, just, I know you're going to get 30, but The other guy can't get 28, all right? I would like a bigger differential there than that.
All right, Coach Isaiah.
And Battier can only take so many.
Only do, and so with Sue Duhon. He can only do so much to help.
They can
do,
yeah.
Coach, I really appreciate you taking the time with me today. And I love you, and I'm so happy that you found a place where you get a chance to have that freedom and get a chance to spend time with Mickey. And
hey, by the way, when is you? I didn't know the third.
Yeah, we have a daughter due October, around the same time as Amelia was born. So around October 10th to 15th.
Well, congratulations! You're for me having daughters changed my life in a very positive. That I'm not against sons, but I had enough of you knuckleheads to coach.
Coach, it is funny. My daughter will sit in one spot and play with toys for hours. My son is just everywhere.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds like you're talking about you as a freshman.
Yes.
So the DNA is in there. Hopefully he'll get some guidance from his sisters.
Yes, hopefully he will. I love you, Coach, and I appreciate it, bud.
Thanks, bud.
All right, we'll talk soon. I think everybody knows Coach K is my coach for life, and he's also a second father to me. He's taught me so, so much over the years, and I can't even put into words how much this man means to me, not only in my life, but my family's life. I also love learning from other guests, Coach Brian Flores and Charlemagne Tha God. There was so much wisdom about how to live and how to thrive, no matter what the world throws your way. Thank you so much for joining me on this mixtape version of The Limits. We'll see you next Tuesday. And as always, remember, stay positive and let's keep it moving. The Limits is produced by Devin Schwartz, Mano Sundaresan, and Lena Sunsgeri. Our intern is Daniel Soto. Our executive producers are Karen Kinney, Verilyn Williams, and Yolanda Sangueni. Our senior VP of Programming and Audience Development is Anya Grumman. Music by Ramteen Arablouei. Special thanks to Christina Hardy, Rudy Correa, and Charlotte Rigby.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.